BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Davy Scott here with another bonus episode of Classic Scottish Albums from BBC Radio Scotland. This week, we've been getting up close and personal with Katie Tunstall's brilliant album, Eye to the Telescope. We were mid-lockdown when I hooked up with Katie on a FaceTime line from LA. And, you know, she's a lot of fun. Let's hear what she had to tell us.
I've actually fared really well during lockdown. I've been gigging my arse off for 15 years. Uh-huh. And I'm always saying, oh, I wish I had a bit more time at home. Cue lockdown. And I've got like 6 months at home. And I've really, really enjoyed it. And I've really needed that for a long time, actually. But I've just never really been able to do it because live gigging is my job.
Yeah.
But I think what the thing I really miss is like just seeing other faces and being having that collective experience. And, you know, I think someone said to me, you know, how come when I do an hour of work, I'm absolutely exhausted? There's no dilution in your day. You know, it's so everything feels intense. And
absolutely. Anyway, listen, it's nice to meet you.
And, yeah,
and
you
thanks
too.
For doing it. Just talk me through, because I'm sort of aware of some of the stuff about the early part of your career, and I know that you came up through some of that sort of Fence Collective work.
Yeah, it was really interesting. So the Fence Collective didn't exist when I was part of that scene. So the Fence Collective actually named itself that after I'd left Fife. But the reason it was called the Fence Collective was because my musical mentor, King Creosote, had a record shop in St. Andrews and called it Fence Records. And then that turned into Fence Record Label. And then it turned into the Fence Collective of a lot of the artists that were on the label. But basically, I grew up in a really, really sheltered, lovely environment in St. Andrews of kind of getting on my bike in the morning and not coming home till sunset, and beaches and amazing kind of natural landscape, and very, very wholesome upbringing in St. Andrews, but very sheltered. So I didn't, you know, you'd have to go to Dundee or even Edinburgh or Glasgow to go to shows, and there isn't a train station. You'd have to get the bus.
Yeah, that's right. It's Lucas, isn't it?
So I didn't, and none of my friends were mad for music, and my parents weren't mad for music. So I wasn't really listening to music until I was in my mid-teens. So I came to it pretty late. And I think the first gig I ever saw was the Waterboys and the St. Andrews Students' Union. And I sneaked in when I was about 15 and got so hammered I don't remember anything. But I started songwriting when I was about 15, when I picked up guitar. I'd started on piano, but I was just writing super cheesy stuff on piano. But when I actually picked up the guitar and, you know, realized that was the instrument for me, I was able to start being a bit more original. And I did my first gig in a pub called The Vic, which is still there in St. Andrews. And they had this kind of back room. And I did a little gig in there at 6 o'clock because I was underage. I think it was 16. And my mate who was working at the woolen mill came along, and Kenny really fancied her. So he came as well. And after the gig, Kenny asked me to join his band, which was the Scooby-Doo Orchestra.
Yeah.
And that was like the back of the wardrobe into Narnia. I had no idea that people were musicians for a living. I had no idea that you could pursue an artistic life rather than trying to get a job. I had no idea that it was actually okay if you don't make money. you can choose that if you want that. And you know, and I think there wasn't an expectation of making a great living, because that was my first run-in with musicians was Kenny and the Fence Collective, and they were pretty anti-establishment, and Kenny had tried to go down the label route and had a really, really bad experience and got burnt. And so it was all very independent. They were still like going to Europe and busking and sleeping on people's floors and going around Europe paying their way, just hand to mouth. And so, and I honestly was so enamored by that lifestyle of that bohemian kind of off-grid lifestyle.
And I'm so fascinated by that, because I think there is a punk thing, not just about Fence and sort of, you know, let's make this thing happen ourselves and let's bust you out. But also from your perspective, not actually picking up a guitar till 15 and then actually a year later you're doing a show and getting sort of, you know.
I know, it was a fast kind of graduation into realising that's what I wanted to do with the rest of my life.
And so what was the music? What was your music at that point? How did it feel? What did it sound like?
So as I said, with piano, I was just writing these really cheesy ballads. I was sort of, you know, like Richard Marx and Maria McKee and all this stuff was in the charts. And so I think my first song was actually quite a decent song, but it was about like Miles and what's her name? His girlfriend on Dynasty.
Okay.
And it was about getting cheated on, and I had never been cheated on. So I knew it was not personal experience that song was from. And and then with guitar, I think at that point, I also I was very into theatre from the age of 8, so I was already into performing. But when I was 15, I had a really, really formative experience, and I got into Scottish Youth Theatre. And I went to Glasgow for 5 weeks, and it was the first time I'd left home. And so it was residential youth theatre course in Glasgow for 5 weeks. And that was honestly wild.
Yeah.
It was so much fun. We were doing a production of Midsummer Night's Dream, and we did it in the Burrell Collection.
Oh, my God.
And then we did it in the People's Palace. And it was just absolutely off the charts compared to anything I'd experienced, because it was a bunch of really, really, you know, kind of, it was a really mixed group of kids. And that was one of my mates on the chorus, who was an amazing goth, gave me a mixtape of all her music. And so the first album I actually bought myself because of that mixtape was the Cocteau Twins, Heaven or Las Vegas.
Oh, my God. I tell you what, that was in the first series of classic Scottish albums. It is a masterpiece.
Yeah, that record is transcendental. I mean, it's just nothing comes close, really, for me to that album in terms of how it makes me feel and what it did to me at the time in terms of opening my taste to music that I still don't even really understand.
Yeah.
You know? And that's fine. You don't need to. And I now as a massive Bon Iver fan, I find that those two worlds are kind of connected in terms of how he writes and what he's singing and how it makes me feel. And but other things on that mixtape, PJ Harvey.
Yep.
What else was on there? The Cult was on there. And then the other thing that was happening in Glasgow at that time were there was, I don't know if this is all the time in Glasgow because I don't know Glasgow that well, but there was this massive popularity for James Brown parties.
Right. That passed me by.
It was literally just James Brown. And you'd go around. We went round several times to house parties where it was literally like 12 hours of James Brown.
Right.
And you just get like mash up to James Brown and dance. And it was absolutely brilliant. And then the floodgates opened because I'd met Kenny. He introduced me to like a bunch of music I'd never heard. I then actually went over to America when I was 17 for a year. And that again was like a massive formative moment of seeing live music for the first time. I saw like the penultimate, well, actually that was later on when I went back to America. I saw the penultimate Grateful Dead show, but I saw Fish show. I saw Van Morrison. I saw, you know, all these kind of big outdoor events that they have in America.
It's interesting you say Grateful Dead, and it's something I maybe come on a wee bit later on, and just in terms of some of the sort of roots of traditional music that we find in Eye of the Telescope, which I know it was and remains a really contemporary sounding record, I think. But for me, there's all these kind of roots in it that are...
Well, I know exactly what you're talking about, and I think the thing that's really interesting, and I'm taken aback myself when I hear it now and I think, God, it really doesn't, it's not dating. It's not sounding like you could stick a, I mean, emotionally, sure, whatever was going on in your life if you got into that record. But in, but sonically, it doesn't feel like it's particularly got a flag in the sand, really. And that comes down to the fact that we, I was so into blues at the time. I was so into kind of all the Alan Lomax stuff and listening to a lot of Howling Wolf and Sonny Boy Williamson.
Robert Johnson.
I was really fascinated with the fact that listening to that stuff, you felt like you were there in the room when they're playing it. You can almost hear the room that they're playing in. And another album, which I must mention, which is still a huge influence on me, was when the first year of uni, when I was just 18 in London, and there was a big CD fair, and my other like hippie goth friend said, you've got to buy some Tom Waits. You're going to love Tom Waits. And so I just went to the W section and picked up the first album I found, and it was Bone Machine.
Oh, yes.
And I knew nothing about him. I knew nothing about the music. And I looked at the cover, and the cover of Bone Machine is like this weird, distorted blue kind of composite negative picture. And I, and the picture of it, I mean, he looks like Flava Flav on the front of that. So I thought Tom Waits was a black guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I listened to the record and I still thought he was a black guy.
Yeah.
And it was quite a moment when I found out that he wasn't. And I was like, oh, well, if your voice sounds like that, then there's no rules that you can't borrow from anything and be influenced by anything. And then the other artist that really was a huge influence and still is that my dad got a satellite dish when I was 15. And of course, that's when I discovered MTV. And I remember the video that, I mean, Fool's Gold by the Stone Roses was like, I was obsessed with it. But the video that really changed me as a musician, moving forward, was Loser by Beck. Because I grew up on Whitney Houston and Culture Club and Madonna and it's all and Kim Wilde and it's amazing music, but none of it made me go, oh, I could do that. I didn't relate to it in that way and I didn't ever imagine myself being those artists. But when I saw Beck, I went, oh, I could totally imagine being that.
Yeah,
with an acoustic guitar.
And you, and the sort of bare bones of it, and it's funny. Maybe it's a good point to pivot right into like one particular song. I'm so pleased you said about the Lomax kind of blues recordings and all that. And I wrote down earlier on when I was revisiting Black Horse and the Cherry Tree. I mean, such an unusual idea for a song. I mean, the central image, and I just wondered if Robert Johnson had maybe entered your world there.
Oh. Massively. He would be the one artist I would quote as influencing that song.
So you're almost encountering something kind of elemental in that song. Talk us through it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really, Black Horse is maybe the most exciting story of a song on this record because it wasn't on the album. We recorded the record in Bradford upon Avon, means Steve Osborne, in a tiny little studio owned by an ex-roadie who'd lost the use of his legs and so had set up a studio in his mum's house. And it was just totally weird. And I'd signed a really small record deal. I'd got quite a big offer from Capitol in America and then Tommy Mottola got fired 3 days later, so it was off the table. So the only record deal was with this record label called Relentless, which were like an Asian underground dance label and they had Nitin Sawhney. But it was the only offer on the table and it was 23 grand and I signed it. So we didn't have a lot of money and we went in to make this record and we finished it and it was very garagey and very lo-fi and very real, you know, along the lines of me loving Bone Machine. I always say, if you want a cardboard box, you want the drum kick to sound like a boot hitting a box, then just hit a boot with a box.
The box.
Don't get a 30 grand mic and a bunch of plugins. And we finished. And I think this happened with Yellow, with Coldplay as well. So the record's finished. It's quite common, I think, that people write singles after everything's said and done because the pressure's off. And Other Side of the World was the first single. The record's finished. I then tell my record boss that I'm going to go on tour with my mate Kevin from Orkney, who's got a band called Half Cousin, and he's opening for the Earlies on a tour of the UK, and there's 16 of us on a tour bus. And I'm like, look, I just want to, and it's in context with the song that I didn't want to sign a record deal. I stayed independent very deliberately for a long time. And it wasn't until, you know, I was 29 when I signed my record deal. And I finally was like, I'm going to have to do this if I want this to work, because it's not, I can't get grants. I can't get any support anywhere without being part of a record label. And so I felt really, really mixed emotions signing my deal. And that's sort of what Black Horse is about, was my feeling that I was signing my soul away to the devil, which you kind of are when you sign to a major label.
I know it.
But
so, it's got that, you know, it does that thing, doesn't it, Katie, where you've got the kind of, all of that's there, but something in the middle of that, and partly the kind of the exuberance of the music and the kind of beauty of the music, it just takes it and it becomes something else, another place.
Well, the music takes over, right? Yeah, exactly. That's the alchemy of it, is that, I mean, that's what I always laugh about being a singer-songwriter, is that you can literally turn shit into gold. You just take, like, the worst situation and write your best song about it, and it ends up earning you money. It's amazing. But with this situation, I was on that tour with the Earlies, having a great time. I was like, what's going to happen in 2 weeks of me being away from London? My record boss calls and, of course, says, you've got to come back to London. You've got Jules Holland tomorrow night. So I go back down to London. I can't believe I'm on the show. And my label boss says to me, play that woohoo thing that you've just written. And I'm like, what? It's not on the record. I thought I'd bagged the single for the second album with that song. And the scouts for Alison, the scout for Jules, had come to a rehearsal. And the reason I wrote Black Horse was because I had been the lead singer for a temporary amount of time with another band on the label called Oy Vavoy, which was like a Jewish hip hop band, because they needed a top line singer and a writer. So I'd kind of worked with them to get to know the label a bit. And their sound guy, I had had a conversation with after a rehearsal and said, I've just been playing solo for so long and it's driving me mental. And my new record is full of rhythm. And he pulled an Akai Headrush Looper out of his backpack and went, try this. And Black Horse was literally me working out how to use the pedal. Can I get a sound out of my guitar if I bash it to pieces through the pedal? Can I come up with backing vocals that will work all the way through a song? And so the lyrics were a complete exercise in automatic writing. I didn't think about what they meant at all. I was literally just riffing on making a song work using this loop pedal.
Yeah. It's funny, though, because I wondered, and we'll come back to that, because I don't want to lose the Jules story, but I just sort of wondered, and I think you're telling me I'm wrong, that was a more broad part of your writing practice, because I think you can sort of hear some of that vibe in things like Miniature Disasters and, I mean, even Stopping the Love or something. I thought that was just something that you did, but so it was very much for in that moment that you discovered.
Yeah, so
it.
Black Horse, probably more than any song I've ever written, I know the least about what it's about.
Amazing.
I did not spend any time crafting the lyrics at all. I didn't spend any time. I don't even think I sat down writing that song, because I wrote the whole thing looping.
Amazing.
And I went out and played it in cafes. And like, I did the Bean Scene tour when they existed. They were wicked, where you play coffee shops. And people were kind of amused by the loop pedal, but they weren't amazed by it. And I was doing all my own setup and all my own sound, when I was doing those gigs. And then, so when I did Jules, I had no idea. You know, I didn't think people were going to be that fussed. And it just went mental. And I was on with The Cure, Anita Baker, and Jackson Brown.
Oh, yeah.
And The Future Heads and Embrace. And then, I mean, it was just crazy because I was running my own website at the time. And I'd get, you know, a couple, few emails a week. And I just woke up the next morning and my manager was like, you've won the online poll for popularity on the show. And I had like 500 emails. And there were some really funny ones. I remember there being one from like a dude who was just going, I'm a punk and I can't tell my mates that I really like you because they take the piss out of me, but I think you're great.
I hope you kept that one.
Yeah, yeah. But it was in my heart.
It was a moment, wasn't it? And I think, you know, most people who watched that show will remember that. And I think it did have that immediacy. And great to hear that story about that song.
Well, also, the other thing to say to finish off the Black Horse story is that there was no recording of it when I went on Jules. We hadn't recorded the song. The album was done. So that was rushed out after Jules Holland. But the first 10,000 copies of Eye to the Telescope have the audio from Jules Holland on it as a bonus track.
I never realised that.
Yeah. So they are definitely worth more on eBay. And then the in a really funny kind of circle of life turn of events, the studio that was free for us to run in and do a quick recording of the single was Chris Difford's place. And then this year I've just been on the road with Jules and Squeeze, which is mental.
Yeah. That sort of, cyclical thing. Another song, and you're going to forgive me because I'm going to be a complete fanboy. One of my favorite songs of this or any other era is Other Side of the World. I think it's a beautiful song.
Oh, thank you.
Katie, I really do. And in songwriting classes with some of my students, I've quite often used it as an example of how to write a really expressive melody.
Oh, thank you so much. I know Kenny, King Creosote, is definitely his favourite as well.
It's a beautiful song. I think one of the things from my perspective as a songwriter myself, I hear the craft in it and I hear the expression in it. And I find myself wondering how much of that was spilled, you know, in the moment, and how much of that was you sort of crafting out a melody that really was going to sort of kill us all, as it does?
Well, it's a really interesting question, actually, because that was one of my first ever co-writes. And I had not co-written really ever until I got my publishing deal and Sony encouraged me to do a few co-writing sessions. And what I've found over the course of my career is that it's very, very difficult to find co-writers that you really click with. And it can be quite a disheartening experience. But I was very lucky because one of the first people they put me with was Martin Tereffa. And he's a Swedish producer, writer living in London. And we have basically now, at this point, written an entire album of material together. We did Other Side of the World, False Alarm, Funny Man, The River from the last album. We've got at least two or three songs on the new album. I mean, every album, apart from Kin, which was the only one I did almost all myself, apart from a tune with James Bay, Martin's on every record. And I remember writing False Alarm with him, which was the first song that was released. It was on the kind of EP before Eye to the Telescope. False Alarm's on the record, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
And False Alarm, I was writing about a friendship that had gone sour. And I came up with the first two lyrics and I went, oh, man, no, that's too hardcore. That's really saying I feel too bare. And Martin, I'm going to do an impression of his Swedish accent. He was just like, no, Katie, it's great. You should tell everybody that it really hurt. And he really encouraged me to just be bare and be vulnerable. And I think that if he hadn't done that, I wouldn't have done that. And so that was having that kind of emotional support. And now we have Martin and I have a relationship with writing, which I do with most of the people that I write well with, where they kind of leave the lyrics to me, but they help me edit what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of, and I think a really good co-writer for me is someone who's pushing me to be more and more personal.
Yeah,
than I would be on my own.
And that's, I mean, I think one of the things about it, obviously lyrically, it does cut to something that people can sort of relate to, that sense of disconnection or you know, just being very alone or you know,
yeah
disconnected is the right word, I guess. But yeah, but it's not just the lyric, it's something about that melody and the way that the melody is kind of delivered, both in terms of its the arrangement that supports it, and you lead vocal as well. So,
well, Martin and I are both very traditional songwriters. We both really appreciate the old school formula of a 3.5 minute song that's intro, verse, pre-chorus, chorus, re-intro, verse two, pre-chorus, middle eight, double chorus, see you later. And most of my songs, the vast majority of my songs will adhere to that, because I just think that there's a mathematical magic in that journey and in that structure. And so Other Side of the World is a very, very traditionally structured song. And I think what's really interesting is Martin not being English, and it always happens with my songwriting with him, he has really interesting turnaround ideas. So that, you know, particularly that line, full of tired excuses, you know, it's a very Swedish way of speaking, of putting the excuses, putting the accent somewhere else on the word. And these little things within the songwriting process, you know, if you think about your favorite lines and your favorite moments, they're always a little bit unusual or conjuring something unexpected or using a word that you wouldn't usually use, you know? And Martin's just brilliant at that stuff. And, it's funny, cause I wrote the song about two friends of mine who split up in my flat in London. The girl was American and he was Scottish, and they'd been together a few years and they met up in my flat and broke up. And they actually now are married with three kids, so I need to write the sequel. Need to write the sequel to the song. But it actually took me until quite recently to realise that the song is 100% about me falling in love with a guy from America when I was 17 and just having my heart completely decimated when I had to leave. And it was a bit of a revelation going, actually, it was nothing. It was totally to do with just relating to the heartbreak.
It's a beauty. There's lots of lovely melodies on this record. And another one that I really like is also a co-write, Silent Sea. I think this is one where I think I can almost hear both sides of the worlds that you're describing in a talk today, you know, in a sense that bluesy, quite sort of naturalistic thing, but with this married with this quite chiming sonic landscape. I wonder maybe if the Cocteau's found their way in there somewhere in the background of it.
Certainly, you know, Liz Fraser's vocal. I mean, the first that was another song that was on that mixtape that I got from my goth friend in Glasgow, was This Mortal Coil.
Song of the Siren, yeah.
Yeah, and that I mean, that's one of the most extraordinary pieces of music. Recorded the way that they recorded it, and it was her voice, you know, it was just like transporting you somewhere else. And so Silent Sea, that wasn't a 50-50 co-write, it was kind of quite swung, where I'd sort of got quite far along with the song, and it's Jimmy Hogarth, isn't it? And Jimmy, another friend from Orkney, fantastic writer, love writing with Jimmy, did If Only with Jimmy as well, and great producer. And again, Jimmy's really, really talented with chord ideas. So he's a really great player. And so he would often come at me with really interesting new chords to try, and new progressions to try. And I think Silent Sea, you know, really benefits from that kind of guidance and in interest. And, you know, it's quite nerdy because it's, you know, it's in five. It's in time-wise, it's in 5/4. And I think that if you're going to use a weird time signature like that, you know, the kind of mark of having written a good song in that time signature is that you almost don't really notice.
Yeah,
it's in a weird time signature.
You know something? It's funny because I always pick up on that kind of stuff. But what my consciousness is drawn to in that song are the very kind of deliberate note choices and the way that you. Really kind of, you know, there's beautiful dynamics and in terms of the way you use rhythm in the melody and all that. And there's another song I think that has some.
Well,
some
I will say, just before you move on, I will say, because you've just reminded me that I also, growing up, when I started listening to music, non-stop listening to Ella Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. And I consider Ella Fitzgerald my singing teacher, really. That was what I was, that she was who I was kind of, her scatting directly linked to how I'm singing on Silent Sea.
Yeah. So it's, there's a kind of freedom in, and it's also, I guess, not just in the performance, but in the way that it's influencing the writing of it as well. So that, you know.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So. One thing, obviously, I was going to mention Heel Over There, which I really like as well.
Yeah.
But I'm also aware of time, and I know that you maybe not got.
It's a bit. I think Heel Over's a bit unusual for me as well.
In what way?
I don't feel like I write many songs like that because it feels like an R&B song to me.
Yeah, it has got a bit of that, hasn't it? Maybe that's also something to do with the arrangement and some of those kind of harmonies that come in. It's very nice,
and it's that opening E chord is really hard to play. You basically have to like have your guitar strapped up high around your ears so you can get your hand around the neck to play that E chord. But it's a very sweet, slightly kind of not jazzy, but it's not a conventional pop way of playing that chord, and. There's a real sweetness and kind of smoothness to that song, which is not that common for my writing.
See, and your writing, I think it's something I've been, you know, I suppose, plugging away at here, and tell me to go away if you want. But I think the thing that I'm always really interested in writers is that kind of mix between the instinct and the craft. So the moments where you listen to something that you've maybe, you know, improvised partly or whatever, and the extent to which you then sort of start to really pick apart the dot in the I's and crossing the T's of the melody. What is your process generally there?
Well, on that first record, we went in with all the songs finished, which I usually like to do anyway. And back then my songwriting process was extremely fast. I mean, suddenly I wrote in half an hour start to finish. And that was very normal because I wouldn't deliberate over lyrics and I wouldn't really come at it from a very crafty point of view. It was more, I was sort of a bit more superstitious about it, where I'd just be like, this is what it is, this has come out. I kind of put my hands on the air and just go, it's not up to me. Uh-huh. My creative brain is telling me impulsively that this is what it should be. And so there was a real simplicity to that process. And there was also a total lack of self-consciousness because I'd not made a record before. Which you think maybe it would make you more self-conscious, but actually I just felt, well, this is what it is. We just put it down. And Steve Osborne, amazing producer, who really was very, you know, instrumental in, pardon the pun, in creating my sound, because he recognized that my right hand, strumming hand, was really, really foundational to how I should sound. So instead of a drummer coming in and playing a straight beat, he immediately, we were working on Miniature Disasters, actually, was the first song recorded, and it just kept sounding really boring. And it was just me and the drummer, and he said to the drummer, just don't do what you think you should do, just copy her right hand.
Oh, that's good.
And it suddenly, the drums are like, boom, chank, 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 chank. Totally different, syncopated, you know, harks back to that old blues stuff. Really, really suddenly much more exciting than. So I've always said since then that people talk about rhythm section and they're usually talking about bass and drums. And I've always contested that in my band, the rhythm section is my rhythm guitar and the drums, and the bass is actually much freer to do melodic stuff.
Do you know the story about the Beatles when they were in the early days in Liverpool, when they couldn't get arrested and they didn't have a drummer, and they were trying to get booked for gigs, and they used to say to promoters would say, "You've not got a drummer," and they'd say, "The rhythm's in the guitars."
But it's true.
And
all that old Beatles stuff. And I mean, my rhythm guitar heroes are Eddie Cochran and the Everly Brothers and Elvis. I just think they were playing acoustic guitars with the spirit of the Sex Pistols. They were like thrashing their acoustics and playing them like you would play electric guitar in a rock band.
Yeah.
And that's how my guitar is called Eddie after Eddie Cochran. But mastering that percussion on your right hand as well as delivering the song is really a valuable skill, I think, of being able to deliver your rhythm through that playing at the same time. But what? So Heel Over like completely stepped away from that. And it was a ballad about a friend of mine who'd been through a really, really difficult, we sat up all night one night and she just told me about what had happened to her, and it was a gift really to my friend.
Yeah, it's a beauty. You started Thanks. Talking about Suddenly I See, one of the things about, again, it's got that, that right hand excitement that you talk about. The whole excitement of the recording obviously translates. So what I'm saying is, put us on your shoulder in the studio and describe the moments of recording it. Yeah, let's talk about the writing of it as well. But
yeah, so
such an amazing recording.
Yeah, I had got a tiny little laptop demo set up in my flat in London. And it was in a little basement flat that I was getting completely fleeced in Gospel Oak in North London. And they were completely remodeling the flat above. So there was just, it sounded like there were workmen in my house from 7 a.m. till 5 p.m. So I could only record during the night. So I would be absolutely knackered, kind of up all night, but, you know, sitting at this laptop. And so I've got the original demo of Suddenly I See. And already it's got, you know, I'd been listening to blues. And so I basically was into the Bo Diddley beat and wanting to kind of explore that rhythmic side of stuff. And then I'd also spent, you know, time listening to old records that I loved for inspiration. And I remember sitting in my basement flat at like 2 a.m, just staring at the cover of Horses by Patti Smith and looking at her and just feeling really hacked off, because here was this woman looking so confident and relaxed and kind of, you know, just almost so kind of relaxed in herself. She's like, well, who are you? This is who I am, you know? And I just spent 10 years desperately trying to get somewhere. And I remember looking at that and just going, I'm so fed up of trying. I just want to do it. I just want to be given the opportunity to bloody do it and stop trying to convince other people that I can, to get it off the ground. And, you know, and I somewhat, in a cosmic wish granted, it made me write Suddenly I See. And it's literally, the whole song is about the cover, is the Robert Mapplethorpe shot of Patti Smith on the cover of Horses.
God, did you ever get to tell her that?
To tell her?
Yeah.
I've never met her, actually.
Oh, man.
But a mutual friend who is a journalist did an interview with me recently and presented me with a very, very kind gift, which was a original copy of Horses, and Patty had signed it for me.
Ah, it's beautiful. That's great.
So I don't know if she knew it was for me, but he'd got it signed to my name, and that's very precious.
But it's great, and I think that, yeah, the energy and the kind of the desperation almost, but that beautiful moment, yeah, of realisation, it's so there in the song. Yeah. And maybe that's one of the reasons why it's gone over so strongly, yeah, with people, because they understand that moment.
No, it's a very genuine emotion. And I think that, you know, the reason that song has gone on to make me over 50% of my income, by the way, all the other songs come, you know, it's way ahead in terms of how much it's used and how much it gets played. I think when you hit an idea that's very genuine and authentic to you, but can be read in so many different ways. And I remember just being bowled over when I saw it at the beginning of Devil Wears Prada, that it actually works for this girl in fashion. You know what I mean? And the one thing that really strikes me about the change in the musical landscape and also the change in my own work is, you know, that song was getting played on Radio 1. It was like, yeah, and it just seems so innocent and so sweet and like so unself-conscious and kind of so uncool, you know? And I guess that was why it was cool.
Yeah, because it's honest and
it was
about
just
people.
Very, very real. And when it came to actually recording it in the studio with Steve, that realness pervaded the entire process of recording. We were gaffer taping duvets on the wall, but we never really went down the route of trickery. It was everything got played in the room.
Yeah, and I mean, it comes across. One thing that interests me, because you're talking there about the kind of international impact of that song, but you know that this is a program called Classic Scottish Albums, and one thing that I'm always interested in is where you think your music, and specifically the music on this album, fits in the world of Scottish music. What part of the tradition do you think it sits?
The thing I find just gobsmacking about Scotland is the unbelievably high hit rate that it has of a huge spectrum of different musicians going on to be globally successful with very varied sounding music. And I was part of the Rip It Up exhibition at the National History Museum of Scotland, which was just amazing. Like, you're going, we are tiny.
I know.
And all of these like seminal, iconoclast artists, you know, all from different parts of a country that you could drive and meet each other within an hour and a half. It was so incredible. But I think my own personal kind of corner of it is for sure rooted in folk. You know, that's where I feel I came from, was Kennyslaw, King Creosote's band. That was where I learned to be a live musician, was basically playing, doing backing vocals and percussion for bluegrass. And Kenny and Ian were still playing in their dad's Cayley band. And I grew up Scottish country dancing. And the first stuff I listened to that I really loved was Joni Mitchell and Nick Drake, and I started finger picking. I didn't start strumming.
So it's the combination of all of that, isn't it? And it's the way that all of those traditions are kind of are kind of coming together, and they do, and they really do come together in Eye to the Telescope. Yeah. I mean, that would take it right back to the first part of our conversation today, was that sense of all of those different musics from different worlds that came in, and it really stands up, as you said. It's as fresh as the morning milk. I mean, it really it just sounds like it was done yesterday.
I mean, I think I'm always going to be a busker, Davey. That's like my essential oil of who I am. If you put it in a burner, it would smell of busker, which doesn't sound very nice, does it? It sounds like you might want to put that burner out straight away. But I've got this troubadour nomadic soul in me, which, you know, over the years has been very at odds with some of the stuff that I've wanted to make. When I've wanted to go to Berlin and make a techno album, when I've wanted to go down a much kind of more produced pop route, it rubs against that foundational part of me, but I quite like that. I like challenging that, but no matter what, it is what I always come back to.
Thank you so much. It has been, honestly, I've loved our conversation. It's been great.
Oh, thank you. Me too.
I love your album.
What a pleasure.
It's a beauty. I really do love it. And
very
and,
proud.
Oh, well, so you should be. Thanks again to Katie Tunstall for sharing so much about her very own classic Scottish album. If you enjoyed the conversation, leave us a review, give us a rating on your podcast app. And while you're at it, you might like to tell us what other albums you'd really like to hear about. What's your classic Scottish album? We're all ears. Next week, I'll let you hear my full chat with Roddy and Rod from Idlewild. They gave us their brilliant take on the making of The Remote Part. I'm Davey Scott. Thanks for listening.
Enjoyed this podcast? Discover more music, radio, and podcasts on BBC Sounds.